There's a wide body of evidence that the broad use of pesticides and this pesticide reliance that we have adopted is contributing to not just cancers, you know, and neurodevelopmental problems like autism and ADHD, but, you know, kidney disease. There's just a whole range of problematic health impacts that are tied pretty clearly to pesticide exposure through food and through the environment. So people need to care about this, and they need to act in ways to try to address it, to try to lessen it.
You're listening to Food Integrity Now with your host, Carol Gervais.
Hello and welcome to Food Integrity Now. I'm Carol Gervais. I am a certified holistic nutritionist and the host of the show. At Food Integrity Now, we like to investigate and explore what's happening in our food supply so that you can make wise decisions for your health and for your family's health. And I'd like to give a big shout out to Ben Sound Music for our intro and outro music. My guest today is Carrie Gillum. Carrie is a veteran journalist, researcher, and writer with more than 25 years of experience covering corporate America. She is a former senior correspondent for Reuters, where she digs deep into big business of food and agriculture. Today, we're going to be talking with Carrie about her new book, Whitewash, the story of a weed killer, cancer, and the corruption of science. Hi, it's Carol Gervais, and I am a certified holistic nutritionist, a life coach, and the host of Food Integrity Now. What you eat and how you eat can greatly affect the way you look and feel, and whether or not you get sick. If your immune system is compromised, you might have brain fog, allergies, low energy, depression, have trouble sleeping, you might be overweight, perhaps you get frequent colds, or worse, have a disease. A poor diet can lead to diabetes, cancer, Alzheimer's, dementia, heart disease, obesity, and virtually all other diseases. I take great pride in working with individuals and groups and seeing how they create such positive changes in their lives. I offer one-on-one coaching packages, or we can design a package just for your group. To find out more, go to foodintegritycoaching.com or call me at 415-302-7100 for your free consultation. I offer phone and Skype sessions, and this really is all about quality of life. Let me assist you to have the best quality ever. Hi, it's Carol again. Do you drink almond milk? Do you know that packaged almond milk contains all sort of nasty additives like carrageenan and barely contains any actual almonds? The good news is that you can make fresh almond milk at home in minutes. Once you taste the creamy, fresh flavor of homemade almond milk, you'll never go back. I make my almond milk at home with a Nutiana nut milk bag. It's great, easy to use, easy to clean, and makes my almond milk silky smooth. Buy yours today by searching the Nutiana nut milk bag on Amazon. That's Nutiana nut milk bag. Or go to Nutiana.com. You're going to love this bag. I'm going to start out today with a quote from Carrie Gillum's book, Whitewash. From the day genetically engineered crops were introduced, they were designed with one primary purpose in mind, to withstand treatments of glyphosate, the highly efficient and effective weed killer owned by Monsanto Company and sold as Roundup. Farmers using the Roundup Ready seeds, along with Roundup, could knock weeds out of their fields without worrying about killing their crops. Then and now, most of the GM crops grown in the world carry the glyphosate-tolerant trait, enabling and encouraging farmers to choose to use this herbicide over any other on their farm fields. It was a brilliant move by Monsanto Company and made the company billions of dollars in combined sales of seeds and herbicide. But it has cost the rest of us and generations yet to come in ways impossible to calculate. Carrie, welcome to Food Integrity Now.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Well, I'm really thrilled to have you on the show today. And why don't we start out with you giving us a little bit more information about who you are?
Well, sure. Thanks. So I've been a journalist forever. always knew I wanted to be one. I just say over 25 years now. I don't like to give the real number here as I creep up in age, but I've been doing this for a really long time. I've covered a lot of different industries, banking and real estate and insurance and healthcare, and I've covered tornadoes and floods and riots and, all that kind of thing. But really for the last 20 years, the main focus of my job has been covering food and agriculture issues, which of course includes covering the big companies like Monsanto and the others who dominate that marketplace.
Okay, great. Well, today I'd love to have you share with us some of the information you've uncovered about glyphosate, which is the most widely used herbicide in the world, and why we need to be concerned about it. So let's start out with you sharing briefly just what is glyphosate and give us a little history of glyphosate.
Sure. A lot of people have a hard time saying it, right? And who's ever heard of it? Glyphosate. But you're right. It is the world's best-selling weed killer. Probably your listeners have it in their garage, but they would know it as Roundup. It's weed killer. It's the key ingredient in Roundup branded herbicide products, as well as hundreds of other herbicide products. It's sprayed by homeowners, on lawns and gardens. It's used on golf courses. It's used by cities and counties, in parks and school grounds and along roadways. And of course, farmers use it, on their crops or around their crops. It's pervasive, really, in food production. Not just in the United States, but, around the world in many, many different countries. And the pervasiveness of it in our food production system, is a primary concern for me because residues are found in food. They're found in human urine. Where every meal that you eat, you likely might be consuming a little bit of the weed killer in your lunch or dinner.
Yeah, that's pretty scary. Well, in the book, you start off with sharing some stories of the farmers that have either been, their health has been affected or, worse yet, some of them have died and they've been harmed by using glyphosate. Can you discuss a few of those stories?
Sure. So, the book opens up with, I guess, the story that most grabbed my heart. And, this is a story of a woman and her husband and Terry and Jack, and they were married for 40 years and had a lovely little farm in Cambria, California. I spent some time at that farm, and it's just almost magical. Looks like it, would be set in a movie somewhere. And just had a really nice life trying to grow, very healthy fruits and some avocados, and they had their grandchildren. And then he came down, the only pesticide that he really wanted to use was Roundup, the glyphosate-based Roundup, because he thought it was so safe. Monsanto had said for years, of course, that it's as safe as table salt, one of the safest chemicals ever to be brought to the market for use as a pesticide on agriculture. And so they used it pretty liberally. And the dog first came down with lymphoma, and then Jack was diagnosed with a very rare form of non-Hodgkin lymphoma and died a really, awful and sad and fast death just after Christmas, the day after Christmas 2015. So, there are a lot of stories like that. And these people, believe, and their lawyers believe, and a lot of the experts believe that glyphosate or Roundup is the reason for their cancer. So you now have, it goes up every single day, it seems like, but, thousands of plaintiffs around the country who are suing Monsanto alleging that glyphosate-based Roundup weed killers cause them to have cancer. And, you know, those Monsanto tried to have those cases thrown out, but they're not being thrown out. They're going forward. So that's a big deal.
Have any of those cases actually gone to trial yet, or are they still pending?
So they are really in the discovery phase at this point. Now, you know, the different individual cases have different schedules, of course. But the first trial in one of these cases is set for June 18th. So that'll be next summer. Mm-hmm. There are also some really important and potentially really interesting hearings, that are set for December of this year, just here in a couple of months, in which this big compilation of cases that we call multi-district litigation are going to have what they call Daubert hearings. They're going to lay out, for the judge, the plaintiff's attorneys are going to lay out their best evidence to show that this chemical causes cancer. And, you know, experts will be testifying under oath as to their proof or their belief as to why glyphosate causes cancer. And of course, Monsanto will put up its evidence. So these hearings in December, you know, potentially could be really enlightening and really important to people who care about this issue and really want to know how dangerous this chemical is or is not. So, you know, I'll be there. I can't wait to listen and learn more about that. Those could be really important.
Will you be covering that with articles? And well, we will look forward to that because I love all your articles that you
thank
do.
You thank you.
So let's talk about the EPA for a little bit and how they test pesticides. Don't they pretty much just focus on the individual ingredient, i.e. glyphosate? You know, if they're going to test it, they're just going to test it alone, but not test the other ingredients, other active ingredients that may be in play.
Right. Well, and first, I guess I would point out that the EPA doesn't really do testing, you know, of any of these chemicals. What they do is they take tests that what they call the registrants have done. So Monsanto, for instance, wants glyphosate to be registered. So Monsanto will present to the regulators, to the EPA, you know, here's a big file of all of the scientific research that we've done that shows how safe it is. You know, and then the EPA will look at that and their scientists will review it. And they also can look at outside research that's been done by independent scientists. But the EPA doesn't do its own research.
Right.
And the bulk of the information that they rely on is generated by the companies that make money off these chemicals, which, you know, doesn't seem to make sense really to the layperson. But of course, the tests are very expensive. And who better to do them? Who's going to want to do them more than, of course, the companies that stand to make billions of dollars off these chemicals? So, you know, it's not a perfect system by any means, and it definitely sets up opportunities for sort of, you know, fox in the hen house or, you know, skewed and manipulated scientific information being presented to the EPA.
Well, doesn't research show that glyphosate in combination with other chemicals might even be more dangerous than glyphosate alone?
Yeah, there has been quite a body of information. Monsanto really even has a hard time disputing that and doesn't work too hard to dispute that. Not nearly as much as they do for glyphosate alone, but yeah, there's definitely been scientific evidence showing that glyphosate in combination with these other chemicals that, you know, help it do, like with glyphosate and Roundup, they have surfactants is what they're called that help the glyphosate stick to the leaves or help them be absorbed, right? So they're not actually doing any killing of the weed. They're doing other things. But yeah, scientists have found these formulations. Roundup is actually probably a lot more dangerous than glyphosate by itself.
Yeah. I think, wasn't it Sarah Laney who said, I think I saw him have a brief chat with Zen Honeycutt of Moms Across America. And in his discussion, he said he has found that some of these surfactants and adjuvants can make the glyphosate like 1,000 times more powerful.
Yeah, Sarah Laney is probably the best known scientist to have looked at these issues, but he's certainly not the only one. Mm-hmm. And this is definitely an issue. And one of the surfactants, POEA, as it's referred to, is such a concern that it's essentially been banned in Europe, and Monsanto has moved to take it out of its Roundup products because of that level of concern. But of course, it had been out there and been sold for, you know, years and years and years and years. This is only a recent change to take POE out. So, and who knows, you know, the safety level of whatever is replacing it.
Right. So I want to talk a little bit about tolerance levels and how the EPA sets tolerance levels, that would allow a certain percentage to be permitted on a range of our food crops. Can you discuss that a little bit, how that works?
Yeah, I sure can. And I got to say, I'm a little cynical about this because the way I look at it and read it, it really tracks backwards. You know, it doesn't start with, well, how much is safe for a consumer to consume? What it starts with is, well, how much do we need to use, you know, how much do we want to put on these crops? And, you know, so what you've seen over the years is Monsanto might ask for a tolerance for a certain crop. You know, they might want glyphosate to be at a certain level allowed on wheat, for instance. You know, and then a few years go by and then they think, well, we need a little bit more on wheat. And so they'll ask the EPA to raise the tolerance. And this has happened year after year after year after year on a number of crops. They say the safe level is here. Here's the tolerance. And then over the years, it'll be, oh, no, the safe level is actually going to be higher. Oh, higher, higher, higher. So, you know, you come up with these really high MRLs, maximum residue limits. And what that allows, basically, is if you are testing food and you do find a certain level of glyphosate residue in food, if it's below that MRL, then the government is able to go, yeah, you know what, it doesn't matter. Don't worry about it, consumer, because it's below the MRL that we set. Now, there are a lot of scientists who believe that the MRLs are just flawed and really don't indicate any real margin of safety for consumers at all. But it does give the chemical company and it does give the user of the chemical and it does give the EPA, a framework to say, you know, this is not illegal, this is allowed. Because really, if the residue of the pesticide exceeds the MRL, it's illegal. It's a violation. And people can be fined, or producers and distributors, you know, there can be ramifications. But the EPA has set among the highest tolerance levels in the world. And they do it at the request of the chemical companies selling the chemicals.
Right, yeah. So they just keep raising the limits so they don't get in trouble. And what is that doing to human health and the environment? I guess that's the big question. So I want to backtrack just a little bit. You mentioned, for example, wheat. And many people may not know this, that glyphosate is used as a desiccant, which is a drying agent. Can you explain a little bit about that and what else it's used on other than Roundup Ready crops?
Yeah. I mean, glyphosate is used with over 100 different food crops. There are really only about 8, you know, field crops that glyphosate can be sprayed directly on top of that are genetically engineered to tolerate it. And those are, you know, corn and beans and sugar beets and alfalfa, you know, and that sort of thing, and cotton, of course. But there are a number of crops like wheat or lentils or oats where Monsanto has suggested to farmers that it would be a really good idea to use this weed killer shortly before harvest to, as you said, to dry it out. It can even the crop out if you have some that are wetter or, you know, conditions have not been the same in this part of the field or that part of the field. You can just spray the crop and it'll dry it all out and you can harvest it. But what this does is it leaves really high levels of glyphosate in the finished product. So, you know, like we have researchers, you know, a researcher at the FDA, a scientist at the FDA has found pretty concerning levels of glyphosate in oatmeal products, for instance, mm-hmm. because oats from Canada have frequently been desiccated with glyphosate right before harvest. And the same has happened with wheat. And this has really become a big concern for a lot of people as they become more aware of it. There are some grain handling companies now. They're becoming aware of it. They're becoming aware of the consumer concern. And they're starting to push back on the farmers and say, we're not going to take your grain if you spray it, you know, right before harvest, because they know about the residue issues. So, you know, again, though, it was a really good way to sell a lot of glyphosate. I'm not so sure it's been really good for our food.
No, not at all. And I think from doing some of my own research that that may be one of the reasons why so many people have an intolerance to wheat. I think the gluten intolerance, I think it's really a glyphosate intolerance.
That certainly is an argument and a theory that is out there and that some people have. I haven't researched it enough to know, you know, if there's good solid evidence to support that. But there certainly are those concerns that you've had all these issues arise as desiccation, you know, has become a prominent practice.
Well, if you look at what has happened, there's got to be a reason for this strong gluten intolerance in this country in particular. So I think it does point a finger in that direction, and I really look forward to there being more research about that.
Yeah.
So I want to talk about, in 2015, the World Health Organization's IARC, which is International Agency for Research on Cancer, declared glyphosate as a probable carcinogen. And from all your research, first of all, how did Monsanto react to that? And can you kind of walk us through what you've learned about this and where we are now?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. They did. This was in March of 2015. And just to make clear, the International Agency for Research on Cancer is an arm of a unit of the World Health Organization. And scientists who do the work to analyze chemicals like glyphosate don't sit there, you know, in the World Health Organization. These are scientists from around the world who are considered to be experts in their fields, epidemiology or toxicology or whatever, and they're invited by the World Health Organization and IARC to come and sit as a team and to review basically all the relevant literature and research that's been done on a particular chemical, right? And then to determine what the carcinogenicity might be. So IARC in 2015 was not just looking at glyphosate, it was also looking at some different pesticides as well, some insecticides. And they did come out and determine that the weight of evidence at the body, the bulk of evidence for epidemiology and toxicology and looking at DNA impacts and things like that, said that glyphosate was probably, that was their classification, probably a human carcinogen. Now, what's really interesting to me is that, so Monsanto reacted, you know, just shocked. They were shocked and outraged, and how could IARC determine that? It was ridiculous, and they've worked very hard since then to discredit IARC. They've had a giant campaign against IARC and these individual scientists as to, they've said they had a political agenda, they said that they used junk science, they said they didn't look at the correct, you know, research. But if you look at internal documents that come out of Monsanto, you see that in 2014, when Monsanto learned that IARC was going to look at glyphosate, they knew that IARC would determine that glyphosate was a probable or possible carcinogen. They knew it ahead of time, and they knew it because they knew what the research showed. And you can see in these internal memos, they're talking about how concerned they are. They talk about how they're going to have to fight the classification when it comes out. And they talk about how they're going to do that. And they get in these PR people involved, and they start roping in scientists. And they talk about how they're going to manufacture outrage and outcry after IARC makes its decision. All this planning for the shock and awe and surprise was done before IARC even met. So to me, that shows that they knew there was enough evidence, that this chemical, you know, was a problem, had some safety concerns. And rather than try to address those or worry about how people might be impacted or how they might, you know, what they worry about is the PR and how they're going to spin it and how they're going to attack IARC. And that really bothers me.
Because weren't there like 17 scientists, like pretty renowned?
Very renowned.
Yeah. One in particular you talk about, I think his name is Peter Infante. Am I saying that right?
Now, Peter Infante was not part of IARC.
Okay.
Peter Infante is a top epidemiologist and has been a consultant to the World Health Organization. He was a victim of Monsanto a bit later.
He was the one that when they came out with that paper.
The EPA was going to develop a scientific advisory. Well, they did.
Oh,
that's right.
Okay, yeah. Go ahead.
Well, his story, we're skipping ahead about a year, but so the EPA, after the IARC situation came out with their classification, all of the regulators, of course, you know, in Europe and the EPA were looking at whether or not to reauthorize, re-register glyphosate. So the IARC classification of a probable human carcinogen, of course, is very worrisome to them and creates a lot of problems for them if they want to continue to approve glyphosate and keep it on the market. So one of the things that the EPA did is they said they wanted to bring in outside scientists to advise them, a scientific advisory panel to advise them on the EPA's own view of glyphosate. And one of those scientists invited was Peter Infante, who'd been basically a government epidemiologist for his entire career, and is retired and a consultant now. But Monsanto and the rest of the industry really did not want him on there. And they convinced the EPA to kick him off. And it was done in a very non-transparent way. It was 4 days before the scientific advisory panel was scheduled to meet in December. These meetings had been planned for months. The scientists had spent all this time reading all the research and documents. And you can see through letters and documents, you can see the pressure put on EPA to get rid of Infante. And 4 days before the meeting, they did. But they essentially lied about it. They denied there was any pressure from industry. They said Peter Infante was not available to come to the meeting, which Peter Infante was very surprised to hear. So, you know, there's just so much that goes on.
But wasn't Dr. Infante, didn't he show up at the, it was a public hearing or whatever, maybe hearing's not the correct word, but he was able to speak as just a concerned person, but not as an expert. Is that correct?
Yeah. So when they kicked him off, essentially, they then had to find somebody to replace him. So they delayed the meetings and they reset them from October 2016 to December 2016. So Peter Infante showed up at those meetings in December in Washington, D.C., and was allowed to speak as a, just a member of the public to make a public comment. And he ended up getting quite a lot of questions from the other scientists and really walking everybody through the epidemiology and letting reporters in the room know that he was not ever unavailable and that he was kicked off and that he was not happy about it.
Yeah, well, that was great that he did that. And he had concerns around non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, you know, that could be, part of the problem with glyphosate, that it could create that.
Yeah, he told me, I mean, he and I have talked many times and gotten to be, you know, friendly, and he helps me understand the science. But the way he puts it is there's clearly evidence, he says, clearly evidence for the risk of non-Hodgkin lymphoma from glyphosate exposure. He doesn't think that it's conclusive evidence at this point, but there is, you know, evidence that needs to be paid attention to, and he doesn't think that the EPA is properly taking that into account, and that the EPA is wrong about sort of the stamp of safety approval it's giving to glyphosate.
Yeah. So has the EPA given its, have they updated their approval of glyphosate, the assessment, or is that still pending?
That is really still pending. They were supposed to deliver a preliminary risk assessment, what they refer to, a preliminary risk assessment of glyphosate in 2015. And in fact, they said they had it done and it was going to the printer and it was ready, right? But then you had the IARC classification and everything blew up. And so we still are waiting. You know, here it is, late 2017. We're still now waiting for that, that document, that risk assessment. But what is taken place over the last couple of years is that the EPA issued sort of a cancer assessment, a cancer report, and they had a group do a the CARC report, which is a group within the EPA that analyzed the carcinogenicity and looked at the evidence, and they said, you know, no evidence, no ties to cancer. The EPA agreed with that, you know, doesn't look like it could cause cancer. Now, the scientific advisory panel told the EPA that they didn't necessarily agree with that, and a lot of the scientific advisory panel members told the EPA they weren't following their own guidelines. So there have been a lot of sort of questions and issues with the veracity of the EPA's internal assessments. So we're still waiting to see, you know, how this, how their final report comes out on it. But, you know, there's just been really some interesting, this CARC report, which was done by this guy named Jess Rowland, or he oversaw it. He was the head of the committee who oversaw this report. You know, he, there's an investigation underway right now to see if he colluded with Monsanto. Monsanto liked him a lot. You can see from these internal documents, they considered him an ally and a friend. He left the agency and went to work, you know, doing consulting work for, surprise, the chemical industry. And the really curious and interesting thing is this, this CARC report that said, you know, no, there's no ties to cancer. We're, glyphosate is good. It's safe. It was not made public by the EPA, but it mysteriously showed up on a public website. In late April of 2016.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Right. It just popped up there, and it was a really good time for Monsanto for it to pop up there because they had some really important court hearings coming up in the next couple of days, and there were some important votes in Europe on glyphosate, and Monsanto was able to grab that report and issue, you know, press releases and blogs and talk about it and talk about it in court and tout it as, look, the EPA says this thing is safe. And then the EPA said, oops, it's, we shouldn't have put it up there. It's not really final. We're not really sure. You know, and they took it down. But, you know.
Yeah. So,
and just, it was about 2 weeks after that that Jess Rowland retired from the EPA. So, who knows?
Yeah. And for our listeners, if you want to know a little bit more about the EPA, I interviewed Evagelos Valianatos, who was formerly with the EPA, and he wrote a really great book called Poison Springs. So you might want to check that out or check my interview out on that. It's quite eye-opening.
You did a great job of saying his name. I have a hard time with that.
Well, you know, when I interview someone, I want to get their name right.
Yeah.
So I practice that. Anyway, so let's move on. You say in chapter 6 of the book, for every scientist who raises a concern about a product, there seems to be a corporation to contradict him. And this is a real problem.
Well, sure. And, you know, I think you've seen it. We've all seen it. I mean, you've seen it with the tobacco industry, right? You've seen it with, you know, sugar and the soda industry. And you've seen it with the chemical industry and certainly not Monsanto, you know, not just Monsanto, but, Dow Chemical has been in the news, you know, this year because of its insecticide, chlorpyrifos, which is used in, you know, some very popular insecticides in agriculture. chlorpyrifos, you know, has a wealth, a big body of evidence showing that it can have neurodevelopmental, you know, impacts on babies in utero and small children. And that can be very damaging to young children's brains. And the Obama administration was set to ban it. It's already been banned from household use. And the Obama administration was set to extend that ban. Courts have ordered the EPA to go forward on this. And, you know, after the Trump administration took over and after the head of Dow Chemical, you know, got on a committee for the new administration, and after Dow gave $1 million to the Trump inaugural fund, magically chlorpyrifos is no longer, you know, set to be banned. So that kind of thing happens all the time. And it was certainly the case with Monsanto and glyphosate. You know, for every study, everything that comes out raising questions about the health and safety impacts of glyphosate, Monsanto, you know, has a counter. And they've done it very intensely, very ferocious defenders of this chemical.
Yeah, it certainly is a revolving door, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, they have, you know, I mean, they're very, these companies have a lot of money, and they spend a lot of money on lobbying, they spend a lot of money on political contributions, they wield great power in Washington, D.C. through lawmakers and, you know, through the lawmakers, pressure onto the regulators, so.
Yeah. Well, you know, you mentioned, and I hope I say this right, chlorpyrifos?
Right.
Did I say that right? I wanted to talk a little bit about Hawaii, too, and basically Hawaii is kind of a hot spot for these multi-agrochemical companies and seed companies, and they're doing a lot of experimenting over there, and I think that's one of the places that they're using quite a bit of it, and as well as glyphosate, so that's a real concern, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, I get emails from people sort of pleading desperate, you know, emails from people over there so often. And it really is alarming when you understand what's going on in their Kauai especially, but some of the other islands, because of their sort of year-round, you know, warm weather and good moisture and probably, you know, they're an ideal area for these companies to, you know, develop these specialty seeds, these genetically altered seeds that can be sprayed with glyphosate or other chemicals. And so they do, and they've taken over, you know, thousands of acres, and they have these seeds and these crops, experimental crops growing all over. And so what that means, of course, is you're spraying a lot of these chemicals, and the data has shown, you know, three times as much sometimes, and of some of the most dangerous chemicals, chemicals that are called restricted use because they are so dangerous. And so their use is supposed to be restricted to very specific conditions. And these restricted use pesticides are just being used incredibly widely on some of our Hawaiian islands. And the people over there and a lot of the doctors, you know, have tried to raise concerns with officials about this and saying they're seeing all sorts of health impacts on children and miscarriages and, you know, birth defects and infertility and all sorts of things. And so far, you know, the mainland, the CDC and some others that they've reached out to have really just said, yeah, we don't see any reason for concern. I mean, so, you know, they've tried to pass laws. They've tried to get disclosure about how much of these different chemicals are being used. And they've tried to get different measures put in place to protect citizens. And the chemical companies have sued them, have taken them to court, have pushed back hard. So,
yeah, I know there's been a lot of activism over there, which I think is really great. And it certainly has raised the amount of public awareness.
Right.
Which is great in and of itself. But it's these chemical companies, they're just bullies. So it's like it's like standing up to the bullies.
Well, they certainly, they have a lot of money and they have a lot of power. And, you know, that's, I guess, how we work in America or in many places in the world, right? Power and money go hand in hand.
Right.
And,
so
it's hard to fight for little people or for people who want to try to fight them or you know, engender policies that go against these corporate agendas, it's very hard to do that when you don't have the money and you don't have the power.
Yep. Well, you had mentioned, you know, possibility of birth defects, and let's talk a little bit about Argentina, where they have, there's been really heavy use of Roundup Ready soybeans, and now some of the doctors over there are really concerned because they suspect that, you know, there's a rise in many health problems, including birth defects and several types of cancer. Can you talk a little bit about your findings in Argentina, what you've researched?
Yeah, I mean, Argentina, it's, again, it's sort of hard to decide which is the saddest story, you know? I mean,
yeah.
But Argentina, again, I guess is another very heart-tugging kind of situation. You have, yes, as you said, you've had a widespread adoption of these genetically engineered soy and the corn, but soy that has really replaced some of the more traditional crops. And of course, with the genetically engineered soy comes the more modern industrial practices and comes a lot of spraying and use of glyphosate and other chemicals on these soy crops. And a lot of the farm fields in Argentina are very close to, you know, villages, homes, and schools. And it's not like it is in the United States where there's kind of, you know, 3,000 acres out there down a gravel road, pretty remote. You know, these are part of these communities. And so when you're spraying these crops, you're spraying these people or their water or their, you know. And, yeah, so some of these villages very close to these soybean fields, they've seen a rise in birth defects. They've seen a rise in, you know, cancers and childhood illnesses and disease and other things. And they've tried to raise awareness, and DOC tried to raise awareness, just like in Hawaii. I mean, the people are trying to fight back as best they can, but so far, they haven't gotten very far.
Yeah, it's really kind of a tragedy. I've seen some pictures of some of the babies that have had birth defect, and it certainly, you know, does point a finger at some sort of environmental toxin and could very well be the glyphosate.
Yeah, and there was an Argentine scientist, you know, who sort of became well known over there for some of the research he did, which pointed to birth defect outcomes related to glyphosate exposure. And he tried to, you know, really promote his research and make people aware of it and raise the alarm. And he was widely attacked by the chemical industry, and they really worked hard to try to discredit him. He is deceased now. He died. But, you know, again, you know, they fight hard. So
they do. Okay, I want to discuss a couple other chemicals that, you know, there's a lot of concern over, and that is, one is dicamba and 2,4-D, and 2,4-D is kind of infamous. It's one of the ingredients that was used in Agent Orange, which they also told us was safe at one point. So I know one of the concerns with dicamba, not only it's very toxic, but it also is the drift. I think I heard Andrew Kimbrell discuss dicamba. He's with the Center for Food Safety, and he said what dicamba can do is it can go up into the air, and it gets into the air, and it forms a little cloud, and it kind of reconstitutes. And then this cloud can travel and come down, you know, miles away. So have you done any research regarding drift and why this is a real issue?
Oh, yeah, for sure. And, you know, this was dicamba, the use of dicamba in 2,4-D, the increased use. I mean, these have been around. These
right.
herbicides have both been around for many, many, many years, I think. I'd have to look back at my notes. I feel like dicamba was 1940s when it was introduced. But again, I'm not looking at my notes on that. But
yeah.
So they've been around. Farmers have been familiar with them. And their issues with volatility and drift have been known to farmers. What's different now is that because so much glyphosate has been used just, you know, used and used and used and used, weeds have developed resistance to glyphosate. So farmers who used to be able to kill the weeds in their fields, you know, pretty easily with glyphosate, have found in recent years that they can't do that anymore. So they're getting these giant weeds that are choking out their crops, costing billions of dollars a year in lost, you know, production in the United States. That's a very serious problem. The answer the chemical company has had is, well, you know what? Let's mix dicamba with glyphosate, and we'll develop dicamba and glyphosate tolerant crops, you know, or we'll mix 2,4-D and glyphosate and develop 2,4-D and glyphosate tolerant crops. So that's what they've done. And, you know, this was predicted that this would be a problem when Monsanto first said, hey, let's do this about 5-6 years ago. I wrote about it then. I, you know, traveled to their laboratories and saw how they were going to reduce the drift and volatility and everything was going to be fine. And all these people who worried that it would, that these chemicals would drift and kill off neighboring crops were crazy. Well, now we find out, now that it's really on the market and being used, we find out these people weren't crazy, and that's exactly what it's doing. It's drifting sometimes, you know, miles and landing on other people's, you know, crops, watermelons or tomatoes or whatever, or non-genetically engineered soybeans and corn, and hurts them, damages them, can kill them off. And so this is pretty widespread and through multiple states, and there are lawsuits now, against it. And, you know, Arkansas is trying to ban it. Of course, Monsanto is trying to block that. And, it's another big controversy, but again, it all kind of tracks back to glyphosate.
Yeah.
if you hadn't had the overuse of glyphosate, you wouldn't have the weed resistance. You wouldn't be piling, you know, these additionally harmful chemicals on top of glyphosate, directly on top of our food crops.
And wasn't it Monsanto that said they wanted to really use this chemical, glyphosate, because it would decrease the amount that we needed to use?
Genetically engineered crops, you know, have long been touted with the promise of, you know, more sustainability,
yeah,
less chemical use, more yield. This is how we'll feed the world.
Right.
You know, independent, legitimate research doesn't support that and hasn't supported that.
Yeah, it doesn't. And unfortunately, there's still a lot of people that believe that. Well, we need them to feed the world. But that has been pretty much debunked. That is just propaganda. And not backed in science. Maybe in the very beginning, but no longer. I think, wasn't it Charles Benbrook who really did that comprehensive paper on failure to yield?
Chuck Benbrook has done a lot of good work, but I mean, the USDA has also, you know, their economic research department and others and their agricultural research, they have done their own studies. And the yield gains that we have seen over recent years are not directly, you know, a result of the genetic tinkering with these crops. The yield gains are improvements, you know, in germplasm and in breeding of the core of the crop. And so you do obviously get some gain if you can keep insects off your crop. Your crop's probably going to yield better. So if your crop, you know, is resistant to or toxic to insects, as some of these, you know, then you're probably going to have, you know, some pretty good yields, but maybe for only a time, because what we've seen with these genetically engineered insect tolerant or insect resistant crops is that the insects are becoming, you know, able to overcome this as well. So, it hasn't proven to be what they promised it would be by any means.
Right. And then there's milkweed, and, you know, it's declining rapidly, and that's really affecting our bee and monarch butterfly population.
Yeah.
Because of glyphosate. And that's really sad. What have you found about that?
It is sad. The monarch butterfly population, I don't know if any of your listeners, you know, see butterflies, monarchs anymore. I've, since doing my research, you know, been on the lookout, and it is difficult. But what researchers have documented, and Monsanto has acknowledged, really, is that milkweed, which is what the young monarch, you know, caterpillars feed on, essentially, it's sort of the core habitat that monarchs rely on, has, you know, been vanishing, largely because of the heavy use of glyphosate, throughout our environment. And so the milkweed goes away, and so the monarchs go away, which, you know, is unfortunate. I mean, monarchs are important to the ecosystem in a lot of different ways, and they're also sort of an iconic cultural part, you know, of our history. So there are efforts underway now to restore, you know, plant milkweed and try to restore the monarch, but that's just one, you know, one of many unfortunate results we're seeing by this reliance on these pesticides.
Yeah, and, you know, when I was doing my own research and, of course, reading your book, Whitewash, it can be kind of overwhelming because when you really understand how the system is actually working, it can be discouraging. Do you have any solutions to offer our listeners? I always like to end my shows with, yeah, this is the bad news, and we need to know about this, but what can you offer to our listeners?
Yeah. We've talked about this. I've talked about this with other people. I certainly don't want the book to just be a downer for people, because when you do read about a lot of these things, it can be very frustrating. You can be worried about your health and the food you're eating and the environment. But there are, in the last chapter, you know, I do try to offer a lot of solutions. The main thing I hope this book does is wake people up and make them aware and make them engaged, right, in public policy decisions. And you might want to change your purchase habits. You might want to buy organic, or you might want to support more natural food markets or farmers who you know, who you can ask about the chemicals that they're using in their farming practices, right? You might want to be concerned if you live near a farm field and somebody is spraying that farm field and it drifts over to where your young children play in your yard. Maybe you need to go find out what that chemical is that they're spraying and find out if they're doing it legally, you know, under which it should be under some pretty tightly restricted conditions, or illegally. I mean, people need to care, because these pesticides are affecting not just the butterfly, you know, and not just the soil, but they're affecting our health. There's a wide body of evidence that the broad use of pesticides and this pesticide reliance that we have adopted is contributing to not just cancers, you know, and neurodevelopmental problems like autism and ADHD, but, you know, kidney disease. There's just a whole range of problematic health impacts that are tied pretty clearly to pesticide exposure through food and through the environment. So people need to care about this, and they need to act in ways, you know, to try to address it, to try to lessen it. So that's what I'm hoping people will get from Whitewash. And there are farming practices, you know, time-honored farming practices that reduce pesticide use. A lot of farmers are trying to do that now. You know, so there are solutions. There are ways off the pesticide treadmill, but people just have to pay attention.
Yeah. Well, I agree, and that was well said. So thank you, Carrie, for being my guest today and for writing the book. And the book is Whitewash, the Story of a Weed Killer, Cancer, and the Corruption of Science. And the book is currently being shipped now for those who pre-ordered it. And you can continue to pre-order it right now. Is that true?
Yep. They're still taking print. Some people who pre-ordered are getting them right now. So
they're already getting them. So great. And then it'll be out officially on October 10th. It'll be in stores, or you can, again, you can order it on Amazon or Barnes & Noble. And I highly recommend it. It's eye-opening, and I think that knowledge is power. And the more we know, then we can act accordingly.
Well said.
Yeah, so thanks to our listeners for listening. And Carrie, once again, wonderful interview with you today. And we'll look forward to following you. And you'll be writing an article about those hearings in December. So we'll look forward to reading that as well. So thanks again.
Great.
And we'll be back next week with another great show.
Thank you.